history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories waiting to be told, if we'll just show up with that willingness to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained. So often, we come away inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Our guest today lives in Clovis, California, where he's about to celebrate his 95th birthday. But there were days in World War II, including nearly 6 months as a prisoner of war, when the likelihood of his celebrating his 21st or 22nd birthdays was not exactly strong. I've been looking forward to bringing you Joe Soldo's story for a long time, and I'm really excited that we can finally do that here in the new year. I first met Joe when he was preparing to go on an honor flight to Washington, D.C. last year, and I was amazed by the uniqueness of his story. We've been privileged to meet dozens of ex-prisoners of war here on Hometown Heroes over the years, including some who survived the Bataan Death March in the Pacific, others who endured death marches of their own throughout Europe. Joe did a lot of marching as a prisoner, too, and he bore witness to some of the most horrific and infamous scenarios throughout that devastating worldwide war. Despite the physical and emotional toll that being a prisoner of war can take, Joe would go on to earn degrees from Notre Dame and the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He met and married his wife, Betty. They started a family, and he enjoyed a long and successful career as a corporate and government accountant. For most of the years since, he never spoke too extensively about his time in captivity. 40 years after he was liberated, Congress created the Prisoner of War Medal for people like Joe who were forced to live in the absence of freedom. President Reagan signed that into law, but Joe never put in for the medal. It wasn't until 2018, 73 years after he tasted freedom again, that he would receive that medal, surprised by his children and his congressman, Devin Nunes. The medal is meaningful, but more so are the memories, which we have the privilege of exploring with Joe today. Well, let's start with your childhood, Joe. Tell me about what it was like growing up in Pennsylvania in the 20s and 30s.
Not much of anything. It was depression time. Everybody was poor. You know, living through it was not bad, but it was hard times.
During the depression, your dad would take a Twinkie with him to work?
Yeah, and bring half of it home for me as a little boy. So I waited for him to come.
And your parents were immigrants from where?
Yugoslavia.
And I'm just guessing that, you know, a 5, 8, 10, 12-year-old kid in the 20s and 30s has a little different experience from that age a kid today.
Oh, yeah.
What were the things you did to stay busy or stay occupied?
Well, I worked at the gas station. Huff's had a service station, and I worked there every night pumping gas. In those days, they had Texaco had a fancy uniform. So I wore a fancy uniform, sold gasoline, got a penny a gallon for me. On a good night, I could make maybe 50, 60 cents.
So you met the Andrews sisters while you were working for Mr. Huff?
Yep.
How'd that happen?
Well, I got paid in an envelope with the money in the envelope, and they wanted to sign and I said, why? He says, we're the Andrews sisters. We're going to Hollywood. We're going to be famous, she said.
While you were a prisoner later on, did you ever hear any of their music and remember that moment?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Did you tell your fellow prisoners that you met them?
Yeah.
Did they believe you?
Oh, I think so. Yeah.
And how old were you when you started working at that service station for Mr. Huff?
16, something like that.
But I understand that he had a big impact on your life.
Oh, yeah. Because I had no particular plans. I was going to go to work in a steel mill like my father. And he said, no, you can do a lot better than that. You can do anything you want. You're smart enough. And if you're willing to work.
So that kind of changed your idea in your own mind?
Oh, yeah.
And English is not your first language?
No, Croatian.
So in the home growing up?
We didn't speak English. We spoke Croatian.
Can you still do that? Could you still have the vocabulary?
Sure. Danas smo išli, neće, ali ne mogu da razumem. We're going someplace today, but I don't know where.
Sounds like something that'll always come in handy. I was just wondering if you could say Happy New Year in Croatian.
No. Well, I don't. Veseli Nova Godina. Veseli Happy New Year. Veseli Nova Godina.
See, it all comes back to you. So you grow up speaking Croatian in the home, learn English in school, figure you're going to work in a steel mill like your dad, but Mr. Huff says there's something else out there. And then 1941, you're 17 years old, and all of a sudden something happened that changed everything. And every veteran I've talked to seems to remember December 7th and how he found out. Do you remember how you heard about Pearl Harbor?
I guess it was just over the radio that I heard it.
Was that a big deal?
Oh, yeah, a very big deal.
Did it make you wonder if the service would be part of your future?
Yes, it did. I wondered about it.
And you turned 18 the next month.
Yeah. I had a full year of engineering that I studied on my own at Lehigh University.
So ASTP was a great deal for a lot of people because it promised you can go to college while you're fulfilling your service requirements. And all these college campuses were all of a sudden, you know, filled with military personnel. And you did yours in Boston?
Yeah. Boston was a very good place to be in uniform at that time. They treated their servicemen very well. You couldn't buy it. You go into a place to eat something, somebody always picks up the tab. Mm-hmm. It was nice.
And you were studying engineering there?
Yes.
So it sounds like you got a whole year in then, and then in your second year they said ASTP is no more, we need troops?
That's right.
And how'd you feel about that?
Well, I didn't much care for it, but you go along, you know.
Yeah, actually, I'm reading here in something that you wrote years ago. You said you were one sad guy, and for the first time in your life, you got completely drunk.
Oh, but yeah, that's right. That's right. They canceled the ASTP program. That's the only time in my life where I ended up in New York, and I don't know how.
And then they take you to Fort Knox and put you in the 78th Infantry Division. How was that adjustment? Did you get to know some of those guys?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was a good way to do it, to train as a unit, as a division, and we did. And it was a good way to do it.
Did they challenge you a little bit? Because, I mean, you'd been basically a college student for the last couple of years.
If a sergeant came out the first day, he's saying, "Oh, you guys go to college?" He says, "You think you go to, you're smart." He said, "You're a four-letter word ending in T. You're nothing."
And from what I understand, you started to figure out you were a pretty good shot?
What, with a rifle? Yeah, I was an expert. They had the first rifle that came out, the M1. It was a very good rifle. You could hit a beer can at 100 yards pretty easy with reasonable eyesight, and at that time I could.
Well, how'd you feel about this idea of going overseas and fighting?
Well, I didn't have any idea. This is what you had to do to serve your country, and I just did it. Didn't give it any thought.
Did you have a sense of what it was like for your parents to see you go?
Oh, yeah. They were very sorry to see me go, my mother particularly, because she was in Europe during World War I and saw some of the carnage that war can come.
I'm sure she had those visions of something like that happening to you.
Yeah. And in fact, when I came home, first thing she did was felt my legs, see if I had all... Really, see if I had my legs.
Well, and the other thing I noticed in reading some of your memoirs, it seems like the Catholic faith was a big part of your existence, too.
Oh, yeah. When I went to Notre Dame, it was an all-male school. It was a Catholic university.
And you had to go through some pretty wild things to make it to Notre Dame after the war. Let's talk about heading over. Did you go to England first and train some more?
Yes, well, we went to the Cliffs of Dover. They threw the nets there, and we practiced climbing the nets with a rifle and with a full duffel bag. It's pretty high climb.
Makes you wonder what's next, I bet.
Yeah.
Well, and how long was it before you got that first taste of war, what combat was really like?
Well, the first day, we were moving forward, and my best buddy was a Yale student, got hit in the middle of the forehead and killed as we walked along.
How do you deal with that? I mean, you're a 20-year-old kid.
This is war. You deal with it, you know. There's just no other way to say it than, you know, it's there and that's it.
You said he was your best buddy.
Yeah.
What do you remember about him?
Well, we used to go out once in a while together. That's about all.
I bet you can still see his face.
Yeah, yeah.
And here you're turning 95 years old. Have you ever wondered what he would have done with these last 75 years?
No, never thought of that.
You said he was a Yale student. Sure, he would have had a bright future.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's been pretty sharp.
When you see something like that, and that's your first day of combat, and your best buddy gets killed right by you, does that make you wonder if you're next?
No. The heat of battle is confusion, noise. No, you don't have time to mull these things over.
You were in an infantry platoon, a rifle squad, or what?
Yeah. Yes, rifle squad.
So how would you explain what your role in a battle would be?
Well, just move forward. Malmedy massacre, I remember, marching along and then coming to a field where about 41 American prisoners were shot. They were all dead. Instead of taking the prisoners back, and they would eventually end in the United States, this guy just shot them.
And you actually came across that scene?
Oh, yeah. And when he got out of jail, he was murdered immediately.
You're talking about Joachim Peiper, who commanded the outfit that perpetrated that atrocity near Malmedy, Belgium on December 17, 1944, and also carried out similar slaughters of prisoners around that area. Peiper served 12 years in prison for war crimes, but worked under a different name in France after his release. He was killed, as Joe said, when his identity was revealed. That was in 1976. So many have heard about the Malmedy massacre, and we've heard from veterans on this show who also witnessed it, even one who escaped from those very same SS troops. But Joe, this was shortly after you were captured, which we're going to talk about in a bit, and you actually witnessed that scene with your 20-year-old eyes.
The bodies were there.
And you guys knew immediately what happened, or you learned later?
No, you knew immediately what happened.
Does that make you angry? Does it make you scared? What does that do to you?
I don't know.
Sure is hard to imagine witnessing that ourselves, isn't it? It's time for our first break, but there's so much more to come with soon-to-be 95-year-old Joe Soldo of Clovis, California, including the details of his capture, the day of his liberation, and you'll hear about one of his prized possessions. I don't think you're going to find this item anywhere else. That's the subject of a few photos and even a video of Joe online at hometownheroesradio.com and also on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity University of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with ex-prisoner of war Joe Soldo of Clovis, California. Originally from Pennsylvania, Joe served in Europe in World War II with the 78th Infantry Division. Crossing the Channel in August 1944, he would be captured 4 months later in the First Battle of Kesternik, a fierce fight in a small German town that left his division with approximately 1,500 casualties in just 4 days. I know we're going to get to that, Joe, but what about those months between your arrival in Europe and your capture?
It was mostly training every day, training with weapons, training with tactics, and so on. Mm-hmm. Mostly training. I was a staff sergeant. Mm-hmm. That's not a high rank.
What would you say were some of the potential hazards or dangers that you were facing, that you knew were out there?
Well, there's a... There's always a possibility that you could get shot. We had one time when we had about a day and a half of steady bombardment. That was hard because you had to stay ducked down and dig deep into a trench.
And those were 88s shelling you, or you mean from planes?
No, they were 88s.
So what goes through your head when you're crouching down as low as you can and you don't know if something's going to land on you or not?
Well, you dig. We had a trench tool, a very good, I don't know if you've ever seen one. They're a good tool. You dig in the frozen ground. You dig deeper. You could hear the shells hitting the side. You just go down deep.
And do you have a sense when something like that is going on, when you're getting shelled for that long? Are you aware of where those shells are landing?
Well, most of them are in the Hürtgen Forest. It's wooded, so the shells would hit the trees and spread down.
So you probably saw guys get wounded by those tree bursts.
Oh, yeah.
How close do you think it came to you?
I have no idea. I don't think that came close, but I don't know.
And were there some what you would call close calls that you experienced before you were captured?
No, I don't think so. Close call, no. One point when we were in camp, a kid from the opposite side had a motorcycle, and he drove into our camp by accident. So we sent him back to prison, and then he ended up in the U.S. on a prison farm. Working. This is the best place in the world for him.
A little different from your prisoner experience?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
What was the hardest thing you had to deal with before you got captured?
Well, it was cold. I think that January, February, and December of 1944 were really cold. There was a lot of snow. It was tough.
But being a Pennsylvania guy, you were prepared for that, right?
Oh, yeah. You're prepared for anything. No matter what comes up, you meet it. Yeah.
Yeah, I know this might sound like a goofy question, but I'm curious if you have an answer for it. When you're settling in for the night, whether you're in a foxhole or wherever, before you fall asleep, what are the things you think about? Because you're a long way from home.
Oh, you think about home, yeah.
Yeah.
And how you can get out and get home as soon as you can. That's what I thought about.
Well, and so many people have heard about the Battle of the Bulge. There are so many different elements of it. Such a big battle with so many people involved. And you guys were approaching Kesternik at that time?
Yeah.
Tell me about that. How did that all unfold? What did you guys think you were going to find there?
For about a week, we fought in Kesternik, back and forth. And finally, we were overwhelmed and captured at that point.
I read that you were down to about 20 people?
Yeah.
It says here that Captain Fix blew his whistle and told you to go into the cellar?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
And pretty soon the gun of a tank went in through the window pointing at us. I thought that was the end, but it wasn't. It wasn't. They backed out.
You knew it was over? You were captured?
Yeah.
So what did they do to you?
Nothing. I could speak some languages, and I became useful to them because of my languages.
But there was a souvenir that you had taken that you had to get rid of first?
Yeah, I had a pistol, a German army officer pistol. And that's a really beautiful gun. Well, I had to get rid of that and not be caught with it, because you never know in war what will happen.
Well, and most of us have never been in that position and never will be. Again, you're not even 21 years old yet. You've been freezing your tail off, fighting, seeing friends get killed or wounded, and now they're taking you prisoner.
Yeah.
Were you scared? Were you nervous?
Not really, because of the languages they had use for me right away, immediately. Wanted me to sit in on all of the meetings and listen to the interpretations and tell them they were accurate or not.
So they were interrogating prisoners and you were translating?
That's right.
They take you in Kesternik, and this is when they marched you past the Malmedy massacre?
Yeah.
Well, you keep telling me you weren't scared, it's no big deal, but I'm thinking, okay, you're a prisoner now, you don't know how long, and now you see these other guys who should be prisoners who they slaughtered in the snow. That doesn't weigh on you at all?
Well, yeah. You hope it doesn't happen to you. That's about all.
What about the conditions? Did you have enough clothing or equipment to stay warm?
Well, I had a beautiful overcoat, long, reaching the ankles, heavy wool. Was a terrific overcoat. That was the first thing they took away from me.
And did I hear correctly that you had to carry your friend on your back for a while?
I did, yes. Dotson, he was small. If I'd have left them back there, they might have shot him because they were not waiting for stragglers.
So they're marching you guys, and yeah. If someone is too weak, or in his case, he had frostbitten feet?
Yeah.
So if they fell out of line?
They're shot. It gives you a good incentive to keep moving.
I would think so. And you got rid of your pistol,
yeah. But
you still had your high school ring?
Yeah, I got that, and I guess I got some bread for it. I traded it for some bread.
So you're walking along the way. And how big of a group of prisoners do you think this was that you were marching with?
I'd say there was 100 people there.
So as you're marching, you see some civilians who have some bread,
and
you were willing to part with your ring.
Yeah, exactly.
It tells me you must have been a little hungry.
Yeah. You do what you have to survive. So it's a question of survival.
But if all of a sudden you have bread, I bet some other people around you wanted some of that bread too.
Yeah, I gave them some too.
And do you find yourself thinking at all, how long is this going to last? Am I ever going to be free again?
No, I didn't give that any thought. Moment to moment, I stayed alive, that's it.
And how much did you weigh when you were captured?
Let's see, I normally weigh 180. I was down to, 140, I bet. I was thin.
You mean when you were liberated?
Yeah, I was thin.
So how did your captors treat you?
With dignity. There was no animosity. They didn't abuse me in any way.
And so what did you do for the rest of that winter?
Walk. Walk in the snow. I don't know where or why. I was about 20 years old in the prime of life. But our guards were old. They were not the fighting troops, you know. They could hardly keep up with us.
And did they give you anything to eat?
Oh, yeah. Turnips. More turnips than anything. I hated the things.
You were walking, and where would you stop?
Usually at a farm. Usually at a large farm that had a barn where we could sleep covered. That's usually what we did.
Did you expect that you were going to be taken to a prisoner of war camp and stay there?
Yeah. I did.
So were you a little confused when that didn't happen?
No, because I know in war things, you know, don't follow the rule book.
Well, and how much would they explain to you about what they were doing? I'm just wondering if, as an interpreter, if maybe you had a little different experience than maybe some of the other prisoners.
Not much.
And I'm just looking at some of the places that they took you through: Stuttgart, Heidelberg, Dachau, Nuremberg. Any memories from those places when you went through?
Cold, snow, and that's about it.
And is this pack of prisoners and captors growing as you go?
No. They went to the different prison camps, and each one had above the prison fence there, Arbeit macht frei, work will make you free. That's what I remember.
Those words were famously posted on the gates at concentration camps like Dachau and Auschwitz, where Jews and other political prisoners were held. But you also passed by prisoner of war camps on that journey. Have you ever been able to understand why they didn't leave you at one of those camps?
Yeah, because of food. I mean, if they kept us, they'd have to feed us. So they kept pushing it off to the next camp.
What about interacting with your fellow prisoners during this time? What would you guys talk about?
Well, I don't remember. The cold, I guess. Yeah. As much as anything.
Did you see guys who were having a harder time than others?
Yeah. I carried John Dodson there for a day or so. He's a small guy. The snow was deep.
And there's one place that you went that I've never met another American serviceman who made it there. And there were famously no American prisoners there, but it's been the subject of a lot of discussion in the years since. And
Auschwitz?
And just, yeah, Auschwitz. Yeah. What was it that brought you guys there, and what'd you see there?
I don't know what brought us there. I mean, we were grouped and told to go, you go. At one point, we got on a train, yeah. And then we were in a marshalling yard. The Americans bombarded and killed a guy in the car that I was in. So he stood for half a day with a dead guy in the car.
These were the old 40 and 8s?
Yes, yes.
So you were probably packed in there pretty snug?
Yeah, I'd say about 100 in there. They packed them in pretty good.
But so while you're stopped at a marshalling yard, American planes come over. Yeah. They don't know that there's POWs inside.
That's right.
And so one of the prisoners gets killed by an American bullet.
Yeah, right. That's correct.
But there's no room. You can't get out to do anything with the body, and there's no room to move?
That's it.
So you just had to keep that body standing up.
Yep.
Well, in reading what you once wrote down, I can't help but see this sentence. It says, the brief stay in Auschwitz was like a peek into hell. What did you see there?
We were marching through it. There were two people that were in prison there. Somebody threw an apple core over. Those two guys fought for that apple core as if it was, you know, really something. That stood out in my mind. They were taking the corpses and taking the gold teeth out of the corpses. One girl was assigned that job.
That has to be hard to look at and hard to understand what's going on.
It is. Yes, it is.
I'm sure there's part of you that wants to somehow do something about it, but you're pretty helpless, aren't you?
Oh, you can't do anything. You're weak yourself. You want to survive.
And as crazy as it sounds, there are still people that don't believe that this happened, that this happened to the Jews. So every time I meet someone like you who witnessed some of it, it's important to me to hear what you saw.
Yeah.
And so people understand that it's true. So what were some of the things that you saw that really stuck with you, that were hard to believe that you were actually seeing that?
They had a big chamber there. You were supposed to go in there to be deloused. Well, they put people in there and gassed them.
So you're seeing things you don't want to see. You're probably hearing things that you don't want to hear. And you're smelling something you don't want to smell?
Yep. You got it.
Have you ever smelled a smell like that anywhere else?
No. I can't say I have, no.
So you probably didn't want to stay there very long.
That's right. And we didn't. We moved on. We went into Poland, southern part of Poland, all on foot in winter, you know.
And can you help us? Again, this is something most of us have never been through. And I know it was a long, long time ago, and no one would ever know, seeing how healthy and strong you are now, that you were in this kind of condition. But can you help us understand the condition you were in, how hungry you were, how tired you were, how weak you were?
Well, I didn't give it much thought. You just had to keep moving, keep going.
And he's still going, turning 95 January 8th. It's break time again. If you pull up the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or go to hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find photos of Joe Soldo then and now, and also a couple videos, one of him playing the harmonica and another in which he shows us the handcrafted one-of-a-kind box he obtained in a trade with a Russian prisoner. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today has a fascinating story. Joe Soldo was just 20 years old and serving in the 78th Infantry Division when he was captured in December 1944 in Kesternick, Germany, near the Belgian border. It was the outset of the Battle of the Bulge, and he would spend the next several months marching through the snow, serving as an interpreter for his captors. One day without freedom is something most of us will never experience, but when it's day after day after day, what do you find yourself thinking about?
Well, I would dream of different things that I would eat. Mm. You know, what was it, a sandwich with a Hershey bar on top of it? And I had all sorts of dreams of food.
Well, eventually, they finally took you to a prison camp and let you stay, huh?
Yes.
So did you get your own bed and everything?
Well, yeah. Matter of fact, we did. We had bunks. I think there were three high bunks where we slept.
Was that at all a relief for you to end up somewhere like that as opposed to this constant movement?
Yes. Yes, it was.
And what were the conditions like inside that camp?
Oh, tolerable, I guess you'd say.
Was the food any better?
Not really. Not really.
Did they have any Red Cross parcels for you or no?
No, I never saw any.
How about that famous German bread that's half sawdust?
Yeah, I ate some of that and, yeah, and some nourishment out of it.
I know, again, it was a long time ago, but you probably remember this. What was it that kept you going, that kept you believing you could get out of this and have a life again?
Well, survival is an instinct. You know, you just automatically, at least I did, I want to survive. Bring that thing out there.
So this is a handmade box. Where'd that come from?
Somebody had it. I gave him some bread for it. Bread was some kind of currency.
This was a Russian prisoner?
Oh, yeah.
And you could speak a little Russian or understand a little?
Understand a little, yeah.
So what was it about that box that you were willing to give up some bread for it?
Well, just look at it. It's really made by somebody with great patience, and it's unique. You won't see many boxes like that.
I've never seen another one, and it's got these ornate decorations, and I'll put a photo of it up at hometownheroesradio.com. Those little designs, that's not paint, that's straw, is that right?
That's straw. Yeah, this is straw.
Well, it's pretty amazing that you've held on to that. Yeah. For this long, that it made it out of the prison camp with you.
You put it in a barracks bag, surround it with clothing, and hope that it doesn't break.
So did you have an idea while you're in that prison camp that the war was about to be over or that you guys might be liberated?
Oh, yeah. I figured it would be. It would be over and we would be liberated. I was making plans, trying to figure where I wanted to go to school. You know, I wanted to attend a university someplace.
But I understand that just that liberation process was a little dangerous, too, because you were afraid you might be killed by the liberators?
Oh, yeah, that's always possible. I hid in a soup kettle. They had large soup kettles. A body could fit in it. I hid in there. Don't laugh, man. That saves your life.
So you must have been planning this for a while.
Why, certainly. Yeah. Certainly I was planning that.
How'd you know it was there and it was empty?
I didn't. But I opened it up. It's empty. I went in.
How long do you think you were inside of that thing?
Maybe 3 or 4 hours.
That had to be an interesting 3 or 4 hours.
Oh, it was. It was. Till I heard English voices. Well, a Scottish regiment was coming through and I could understand them.
What were you hearing before that?
German.
I wonder whatever happened to that soup kettle, if it was big enough to fit you in.
Please. I'm not that big.
So this was about the third week of April, 1945, that you get liberated. When you came out of that soup pot and came back out, what did that feel like? Did you realize you were free already?
Yeah. Well, how did it feel like? Well, pretty good.
Well, that's what I'm interested in is that emotion, because I'm sure there were some days, I mean, you'd been a prisoner for 5 months by then, that there had been some days where you probably weren't completely sure you were ever going to be free again.
No, I always had faith.
Yeah?
Yeah, then I'd get out, I'd be all right.
Well, so now that day you counted on was finally here.
Yeah.
Did you do something to celebrate?
Yeah, I ate.
Well, I've talked to a lot of ex-prisoners of war who ate and ate too much and got sick lost it all.
Oh, yeah. They warned us about that. Don't eat too much.
And this whole time you were a prisoner, had you had any contact with your family at all?
I haven't, no. However, my family was notified that I was a prisoner.
So I'm guessing you were pretty eager to get back home.
Well, sure.
Tell me if this is wrong, but I understand that there was some concern on your part and probably some of your other fellow prisoners that they might send you out to the Pacific?
Oh, yeah. We were told to go to Iwakuni and prepare to invade Japan. And boy, I didn't like that. I mean, you survive one war and then you go to another. But Harry Truman had the two bombs, the bomb at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that stopped it.
So what was it like after all of that to finally come home again?
Oh, it was good to get home. I could go about my business. I wanted to get an education. I wanted to go to a university somewhere. I was trying to pick one out.
And before you went to Notre Dame and on to Wharton, two pretty prestigious schools, I'm sure you had a little bit of reunion with your family. Tell me about that moment when you saw your folks again.
Well, it was a happy moment. My mother was checking me out to make sure I had all my limbs. It was a happy moment.
Did you tell them much, your parents, your brother, your sister, did you tell them much about your time in captivity?
I don't think so. I don't think I talked too much about it.
But you held on to this box, box you traded a Russian prisoner for.
Yep.
What do you think about when you look at it now?
Oh, I think it's a very special box. I mean, you couldn't get that from me.
What kind of memories does it bring back to you when you hold it in your hands and feel it?
Memories of the war, I guess.
You talked about that instinct to survive, but when you look back on it now, when you even hear yourself telling the story of the places you were, the people who died, the things that you went through, the weight you lost, how many days you went without food, has it ever been hard for you to believe that you made it through all that?
No. No, I have a survivor instinct. I want to survive.
Well, that was my question. How do you explain your survival? What do you credit it to?
The Lord. Prayer.
I guess you had a lot of time to pray if you're a prisoner, huh?
Yeah, sure did.
What do you pray for in a situation like that?
Family. I prayed I wanted to have a family.
Well, I know that's a prayer that was answered. So you come back, you go to Notre Dame, you go to Wharton, and then what kind of work did you do?
I was an accountant. Well, I worked my way through Notre Dame, cutting hair. I gave haircuts for $1, and I could do about 7-8 an hour. And the guys all needed haircuts. I ended up with $2,000 cash from that effort.
Well, I don't want to forget to ask you either about this experience you've had in the last couple years with Honor Flight. So you got to go back to Washington, D.C. with a bunch of other veterans to see the National World War II Memorial. What was that experience like for you?
That was an outstanding experience. Penny and I were able to go, and it was a great experience.
Was there a certain element or moment within there that held the most meaning for you?
Probably the marble with all the names of the guys.
What did you think about when you were at that World War II memorial and you realized that all those gold stars up there symbolize 406,000 Americans like you who didn't get to come home like you did?
Well, you think about it and you're glad it happened that way. I didn't look back and say you got killed. Didn't dwell on that.
Again, most of us don't have this perspective of having been a prisoner, of having lived without freedom. Are there ways that you can see that experience you had, spending 5, almost 6 months in captivity, are there ways that that affected the way you experienced life after the war, the way you saw things, the way you perceived things?
It must have had an effect on it. I couldn't identify what that effect might be.
I'm guessing that you probably don't take a whole lot for granted.
No.
How long you been playing the harmonica?
About 60 years.
What's your favorite thing to play?
One hair?
You are my sunshine, a reflection on the positive outlook Joe has always maintained, as well as his affection for his late wife, Betty. One of their sons, Andy, is a West Point graduate who has just come to learn some of these details of his dad's story in the last decade. And I felt like I had to ask Andy if he's ever imagined himself in his father's shoes in World War II.
Oh, sure. Having been in the Army and not in wartime, but having spent the time in the Army, I did often wonder what it was really like going through all of that, and been pretty amazed at what it must have been, even though he doesn't talk about it much, never has.
And when he does talk about it, it sounds like it's not that big a deal to him.
He's always been such a positive, make the best out of whatever the situation is. And so even as you heard, yeah, I was captured, and, you know, just make the best of the situation, look forward to it optimistically, and that's really the way he's pretty much approached everything.
As you've heard bits and pieces of his experience, especially that time as a prisoner, is there a part of that, a moment in that, an incident that just really grabs you and amazes you?
Well, I think there's so many of them from the standpoint of from the capture itself, in Kesternik, marching in the snow, carrying his friend past the bodies at Malmedy, to the time in Auschwitz, and as he has described that, and just really the horror of watching the corpses that were brought out of the gas chambers. And as he has described it previously, just the dead look in the eyes of the lady who all day long, day after day, pulling the gold teeth out of the corpses, and then, of course, the smell and all of that. And I had the privilege to visit Auschwitz at one point, and, of course, it wasn't the same thing, but just to know, in a sense, that I was there in Auschwitz, and actually he didn't tell you this part, but after having watched them go through the gas chambers and all, and of course they brought them into the same chambers there for actual de-lousing. So, you know, certainly having watched that, and then, okay, it's your turn to go in, must have really been quite the event. And of course the story of his liberation, you know, those are kind of the big things that I remember. And most of those really didn't know anything about till the last, 10, 12 years.
Well, that must be something to learn all those things about your dad all these years later.
It's recognizing that there's a whole lot more, to people and their stories than you ever know, because many people are like my dad, and I've known other veterans of the war. I really try and tell the young generation, sometimes you look at these people and you say, oh, this old person, they've never done anything. They never, they're nothing. They don't really know what it's like snowboarding or any of those exciting things. And that's like, sit down and talk to them, or rather sit down and listen to them and learn their stories.
Was your dad's Army background part of your decision to go to West Point?
Absolutely. As I was young and trying to grasp what I was wanting to do, eventually, with a few fits and starts, I decided military service career would certainly be a good place to start. Wanted to do it as an officer, so I applied for the academies. Like many of the era, I wanted to fly a jet, but I knew my eyes wouldn't make it through that. So then beyond that, I wanted to do the Army. When I got through West Point, my choice, a branch out of that, was the infantry, because if you want to know what the Army's like and what it's about, you start in the infantry.
You're probably thankful your infantry experience was a little different from your dad's, huh?
Absolutely.
Well, and not to be melodramatic, but I think this is a true statement. You never would have gone to West Point. You never would have had your family. You never would have been born if he didn't survive. He talked about that survival instinct. How often have you thought about that? Because I'm sure he must have come pretty close to not being here.
Yeah, I think there was the survival instinct, and I think he's always talked about that. He says, I'm a survivor, and I've been in various situations and everything where his advice is always just, you do what you need to survive. It's very much been that. But the reality is, his Yale buddy was, 2 yards off of his shoulder on one side or the other. And survival isn't always by choice. It isn't by willpower. It isn't by might. But it's really by the blessing of God. And that's what I see.
Anything else you want to say about him?
He's a great guy. I wish people would appreciate not just him, but the whole generation that way.
One last thing. Do you think there is a lesson, is there something we can understand because of his story and what he went through that can help us, that maybe helps you as you approach your life?
That's a good question. He's always had that very strong, I'll make it work spirit, and recognizing that it would take work. Things don't just come. But you can succeed. Kind of going back to his mentor at the gas station, Mr. Huff, who told him, you can do and be anything you want to be if you're willing to work at it hard enough.
His life has certainly been a testament to that idea. That was Joe's son, Andy, but I think we should give Joe the final word. What do you think your secret is to staying so sharp and in such good shape at 95 years old?
The secret is a good diet. And plenty of rest. Uh-huh. Get a good night's sleep.
You think I could beat you in checkers?
No.
You want to?
Well, you ask. I don't think you can. But maybe you're good enough.
No, I sure wasn't good enough. So I'm going to add my skill at checkers to that long list of things that could never defeat Joe Soldo and his resilient spirit. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again of what ex-prisoners of war like Joe know more deeply than we possibly can. Our freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.